I'm turning this evening to the book of Judges, chapter 7 and verse 1. Judges chapter 7, verse 1. Then Jerubbaal, who is Gideon, and all the people that were with him, rose up early and pitched beside the well of Herod, so that the host of the Midianites were on the north side of them by the hill of Moreh in the valley. And the subject will be surprising aspects of spiritual warfare, because there are several in this chapter, and just going into chapter 8, of aspects of spiritual warfare that may astonish us if we're not already familiar with them. We spent some time last study looking at Gideon and reminding you of Judges in particular. These were spiritual men, all of them. So far as we can see in the record of the Judges, they are holy men and spiritual men, earnest men. They are not without falls, but when there is a fall in the book of Judges, and there will be with Gideon, two very grave mistakes in particular he will make in the future, as there was a great fall with Samson, the record is quite clear about it and tells us that it is a fall and tells us the outcome and the result of it. But unless there's an absolute indication that a particular judge has fallen and sinned in some way, we do not go through the book of Judges assuming that they are carnal, earthy men acting out of impulse, acting as unsaved men. And that is, unfortunately, or has become the fashion among commentators in recent years, to be highly critical of the judges. We cannot be highly critical of them because we are guided by Hebrews chapter 11 and the tremendous statements made, particularly of these judges, in verses 30 to 32 of Hebrews 11, signifying that they were spiritual men and that they acted by faith and that they are indeed heroes of faith. So we have to take them seriously. And if there is something, an act, which may surprise us or look dubious, we look most carefully before we assume that it was a carnal act or it was suspicious in any way. And invariably, we find it isn't so. It is in obedience to God. It is an act with faith behind it. And so we're looking in this spiritual manner at the book of Judges. And the remarkable thing is, as soon as you do what might be called the pastoral potential of each passage, is immediately apparent. The message is obvious and plain. If you assume that judges were earthy and capable of being great rogues and not particularly spiritual, the pastoral message disappears. All you can say of them is something like, amazing, God uses some quite unfaithful instruments. That's all you can say. But the book of Judges is shining a light into faith and what it is, and exploits of faith. And here we can prove it within the book of Judges. Of course, Hebrews tells us that they had heavenly expectations, that they walked as men who were looking forward to a heavenly future. They weren't only concerned about territorial, geographical Israel and its preservation. They were spiritual men. They clearly believed the Bible as they had it, consisted in their time only of the Pentateuch, what we know as the five books of Moses, and the book of Joshua. But that is their scripture, and they look to it and follow it. The Lord appears to several of them. Great theophanies, appearances of the angel of the Lord, the pre-incarnate Christ. to them, and they acted by faith. So let's just go to chapter 7 in this first verse, where the defense to repudiate the Midianite oppression begins in earnest. Then Jerubbaal, who is Gideon, and all the people that were with him, and so on, rose up early. My first heading quickly then is a surprising sifting of the people. And I dare say you're quite familiar with this passage. So we'll look at the things particularly which have application to us in our day. Now, if you look, glance at chapter 8 and verse 10, you get some interesting figures, that there was a remnant of 15,000 men to be dealt with, and there fell 120,000 men of the Midianites, and obviously you add that together, and you're looking at a host of 135,000 at least, because that figure doesn't account for the Amalekites and the others who were with them. So it's a vast host. And as you look at the figures in chapter 7 of Judges, well, Gideon started with recruiting men from three tribes, his own tribe of Manasseh and two others, and the total armed men were 32,000 against an absolute minimum of 135,000. So they must have felt fairly afraid for the outcome. How can such a small force overcome such a powerful force? And yet there's this surprising sifting. Verse 2, and the Lord said unto Gideon, the people that are with thee are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hands, lest Israel vaunt themselves against me. Mine own hands hath saved me. Well, the glory of God must be preserved. And it's certainly true that if God worked the miracle of victory in such a way that a force of 30,000 plus overcame a force of 130,000 plus, then the victors would be proud indeed. And they would easily begin to assume that they had something to do with this phenomenal and outstanding victory. And so they're to be sifted and the numbers reduced. The glory of God is paramount in his work. And this is a figure of Christian work, of spiritual work. It all begins in a spiritual manner in chapter 6 and verse 28, which we've already looked at. And when the men of the city arose early in the morning, behold, the altar of Baal was cast down, and so on. The overthrow of Baal and the restoration of the worship of the one true God. This is a spiritual mission, an activity. And so the glory of God is paramount in what shall take place. I remember many years ago preaching at a meeting, an anniversary meeting, and there were a little group of men there talking to me afterwards. It was quite a big meeting with a number of speakers. And one of them said wistfully, oh, for the days of George Whitefield. When will God raise up another like person? And in his voice, it was very earnest, and it's a perfectly reasonable sentiment to utter, but this was the only hope for souls, the only hope for awakening, the only hope for any movement of God, people to be converted, is that God raises up somebody of the capacity, the apparent capacity as a preacher of 18th century George Whitefield. But you've got the same kind of thing that you've got here, which God doesn't want. Trust in some, and George Whitefield was a mighty servant of God. I don't deride him for one solitary second, but this trust in some human instrument, some particular means of securing the blessing. I can remember when I was a youngster, when Billy Graham was being promoted in London in the 50s, and some of the big print on the posters would say, choir of 5,000. Well, what difference will that actually make to souls? It's entirely peripheral. I'm not going to comment one way or the other whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. But there's trust in it. This will knock the people over. This will make a mighty impact. But we have to learn in every generation that that is not the mind of God. He works through his word by the power of his spirit. He doesn't want all the embellishments of today, all the amplification and the echo tunnel circuitry and the strobe lights and the imitation of the theatrical and so on, the great performance, the big impact. If only people would realize this is less likely to secure the blessing. And we have these words ringing in our ears. The Lord said unto Gideon, the people that are with thee are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hands, lest they vaunt themselves and the glory of God is diminished. It's not what God wants. And we are such hero worshippers by nature that we constantly make this mistake. So there's this surprising sifting. And in this literal historical event, which will nevertheless be a type of how God wishes to perform the work of spiritual blessing, the numbers are reduced as an example and a demonstration. And in verse 3, now therefore go to, proclaim in the ears of the people, saying, whosoever is fearful and afraid. You might think that's just repetition. It isn't. The first word, fearful, translates a Hebrew term, which is quite elastic, but yes, it's fear, but used very much for awe, overawed. It's almost the low end of fear. Anybody who's overawed by this Midianite host, send him home. Whereas afraid is the other end of the spectrum or the scale of fear. It comes from the Hebrew word to shudder or to tremble. So you've got the full range there, from the person who's just overawed to the person who's shaking inside himself. Send them all home. Announce to the people that if they're anxious, if they're overwrought, if they're disturbed at what the outcome could possibly be, if they're shaken at the sight of this vast host of Midianites, or if they're literally shaking with fear, then they can withdraw. And there returned of the people 22,000. The whole range of nervousness to terror. And there remained 10,000. But that has an application for us too. You could translate this into faithlessness. Obviously they were afraid. We understand human fear. Afraid enough to go home. You do wonder actually if that wouldn't have made them more afraid. If we all go home, if we're frightened of what might happen in a battle, if we go, it'd be even worse if we all go home and we're just overrun once again. Anyway, they all withdraw. They don't withdraw far overnight. They obviously lodge in their tents for the night before going home, because we read a few verses on that once the battle is all but won and the Midianites are on the retreat, thousands of them join in the pursuit. When the going now has become easy and the Midianites are put to flight, they pluck up courage and join in. So they redeem themselves to some extent. But nevertheless, in the first instance, they want to go home. Same as us. With us, we're not talking about fear, we're talking about lack of faith. You could put it like this, perhaps I'm going a little too far with this, that we'd all be out visiting the neighborhood and the doors if we really believed that the outcome would be that souls would be saved. But maybe our trouble is our faith has failed. and we don't really believe it'll do any good. So on a cold night, or a dark winter's night, the brave souls that go out and visit a community or visit Sunday school children or seek to serve the Lord in this way, we won't be with them. Because inside ourselves, though we're not going to articulate it, we think it doesn't do much good. We don't have much faith. I won't stick my neck out in my place of employment, we think, and make myself unpopular and become jeered at, and perhaps denied promotion because I'm one of those Bible people, because I don't really think it will lead to anybody coming to the Lord and being saved. I wonder if the nervousness, even to cowardness, that was displayed by so many of those Israelites, the equivalent in us is a lack of faith in the power of the Lord and his willingness to bless. It's true, he doesn't bless in this present time on the scale we might like, the scale of reward and people being saved, but it's faith and lack of that which is our equivalent of the anxiety and the nervousness which you see here. So we mustn't be too quick to despise them as cowards. What about us and our faith? Well then, the situation moves on. And in verse 4, you have the people are yet too many. Bring them down unto the water, and I, put an emphasis on the I will try them for thee there. And it shall be, and you know the narrative, here it is, so many will not go with you, so many will go with you, and it will all depend upon the manner of their drinking. Do they lap like a dog, which will involve, the narrative explains, cupping water in their hand, so they remain standing, and they bend down and cup the water and put it to their mouths? Or do they, without hesitation, go down on their hands and knees and put their mouths in the stream or in the water and guzzle it? Which do they do? Now, Gideon is not told which will indicate who is to remain with him and who is to go until after it's happened. He's probably quite puzzled. He may not be. I think he got it very early on, and I'll explain. So he brought down the people unto the water, and verse 6, the number of them that lapped, putting their hand to their mouth, were 300 men, and those turned out to be the ones that were chosen. Now many people, and they could be right, they say the reason for this is that it distinguishes between guzzlers and sippers, if you like. The guzzlers are the people lacking self-control who see the desirable water, and they're perhaps inclined to be greedy and indulgent people, and they take as much of it as they can get, not knowing when they'll get another drink. Whereas the more self-controlled and restrained drink the water in a more careful manner. And many people think that's the distinction, and it reads character. But I think much more likely is the alternative explanation, which actually draws from scripture, true, later scripture, and particularly where the Lord speaks to Elijah of the 7,000 who don't bow their knee to Baal, the people who stood and cupped the water to their mouths were people who felt that groveling on the ground and kneeling was too much like Baal worship. It was something they never did, and they remained standing, whereas the Israelites who were compromising and still had idols in their home and still indulged in Baal worship, to them it was nothing for them to fall on their knees and put their mouths to the ground. It was their daily act of idolatrous worship. And so it's more likely, I think, that this simple test distinguished between the compromisers and the non-compromisers. Anyway, it gives a better pastoral lesson, doesn't it? The faithless, the nervous, were excluded in the first sifting. Now the compromisers, the people who don't mind going on their knees, it's their customary Baal worship, are excluded. That would certainly make good sense to me anyway. But it's all revealed to Gideon step by step. And he carries it out. And there's a lesson even in that. But there's something else going on here. Why did Gideon ask only three tribes to help in this? His own, Manasseh, and two others. Why didn't he send his recruiters to Ephraim, the largest tribe, which was just at hand, was so near? Why are they not involved in this? This made trouble later on, as we shall see if we hurry, but he didn't ask them. And so the commentators worry about this. Why did he not ask others, Ephraim in particular? And I think the best answer is probably the most obvious one, because God had given him the commission. In chapter 6, he speaks to him, "You will be the deliverer of Israel." And he's a nobody. His family are quite rich, not rich enough to subsidize this whole endeavor. Of course not. But nevertheless, they're obscure. And a kind of upper middle class family, if you like, in the land. But not princes, priests, prophets, no authority. And he says to the Lord, "How me? I don't count. I'm no one. I have no status, no influence, no means to go about this." And he realizes he certainly would not win the support of Ephraim. "Ephraim, don't you know we're the largest tribe and we're the most important tribe and we're the most powerful, actually the least affected by the Midianite oppression?" You wonder why they hadn't rallied to the flag before. But nevertheless, they didn't. They weren't troubling to help Manasseh and the others who were right in the way of the Midianite oppression. But anyway, I'm sure Gideon realized, "They won't accept me. If I involve Ephraimites, they will want to be in charge. Why, they've come from Joshua. He was an Ephraimite, the greatest recent leader since Moses. And they were a very proud tribe and dominant tribe. So he can't have Ephraim. And he leaves them out of the reckoning until the mop-up operation on the very end." And he was going to have to pay a price for that, as we shall see. But it was the right thing for him to do. So first of all, the pride of Ephraim gets them excluded from the deliverance of the tribes from oppression. Then the people who are fearful, and then the compromisers. So you've got three sets of people all left out. There are the pastoral lessons for us. Now, these days, it isn't done by exclusion. Fortunately, it's no part of the pastoral role or the role of the elders to somehow discern our individual spiritual status and say, "You lot are disqualified from Christian service, and you lot are not." We don't have that discernment, and it doesn't fall to us. But it does affect whether God will use us or not. And if there's pride, fear, faithlessness, or compromise, we can't be used. We see those lessons from this model campaign. That's why it's preserved. These things are written for our learning, says the Apostle Paul. Well, then I go down to verse 9, and quickly, the surprising intelligence. And you know the story. Came to pass the same night that the Lord said unto him, Arise, get thee down unto the host, for I have delivered it into thine hand. But if thou fear to go down, was Gideon afraid? Well, he may have had a natural fear, but his faith was strong. Hebrews 11 tells us that. But I think he feared for his 300, not just for himself. When my 300 see this vast array close up, they will be unable to fight. If thou fear to go down, God is willing to give a great assurance. Go thou with Phurah, thy servant, down to the host, and thou shalt hear what they say. And he did so. He took his armor bearer, and he stole right down to the enemy lines. So after all, though he fears to go down in a sense, I think it takes immense courage to go right down to the enemy lines and possibly even penetrate them close enough to hear what's going on in the tents. And he's only got his armor bearer with him. So we're mindful of that, lest we should think it's craven fear. And then they hear this Midianite telling his fellow his dream. And it's a very interesting dream in verse 13. To us, the dream is almost immaterial. It's what the Midianites made of it. And when Gideon was come, behold, there was a man that told a dream unto his fellow and said, Behold, I dreamed a dream, and lo, a cake of barley bread. That's interesting, barley bread, the cheapest type of bread. This bread is going to represent in the Midianites' mind Gideon. So they don't think much of him on the one hand. He's just the lowest, cheapest piece of common bread. It would have been round, this small loaf. And it's rolling in the dream along the ground. And then something extraordinary happens. When it gets to the camp, it runs into a tent. The words that are used to describe this tent in the Hebrew are interpreted by some from Josephus on to describe a royal tent. Whether they're embellishing the story or not, I don't know. But they say this was the tent of a general or the king of one of the Midianite tribes. It's possible. It's an illustrious sort of word. But this extraordinary dream, with this cheap piece of circle of barley bread, mows down the tent. And others say that the words that are used in the Hebrew are elsewhere used, often as a collective noun. So they embellish the picture further. And they see this round loaf of bread mowing down a horde of tents. That could be possible. Our King James translators are taking the more moderate line in their translation. Anyway, that's the dream. And the fellow answered, and this indicates the morale of the Midianites, This is nothing else save the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, a man of Israel, for into his hand hath God delivered Midian. So Gideon and his armor bearer return to the camp and are convinced that God has inflicted upon this vast, vast encampment of Midianites a fear of them. God has done something which makes a tremendous difference. It's a surprising intelligence. God has worked in their minds. For some reason, it's just the work of God. They are terrified of you. And their entire attitude has changed. they're going to flee. You're going to defeat them. Well, this too has an application for us, because it does mirror exactly how God works and how he worked in us, how he works in others. Indeed, the iron resistance of human beings to the gospel. How will people ever be saved? We can do all the things we know about in the scriptures. House-to-house visitation, where in olden times they filled Jerusalem with the knowledge of their doctrine. We can gather people together in meetings and preach to them. God's favourite method, if you like. We can do all these things, and yet the hardness of people, the indifference, despise, as we once did, despise us and our message. And then, just as he did with the Midianites, God casts terror into their hearts. And suddenly somebody says, how am I going to be cleansed from my sin? How can I face God? If I died, what would become of me? And people become anxious. I can't understand that man becoming anxious. He's never been anxious about spiritual things before. Something mysterious has happened. Something I can't trace and see. That man was obdurate. That woman was so stubborn when it came to spiritual things. Could be perfectly nice and charming about anything in the world, but spiritual conversation, she shut me down straight away. Turn me away with a flea in my ear. Nothing can get through her hide. And suddenly she wants to know. And suddenly she's anxious. And suddenly he's seeking the Lord. And suddenly the most painful thing I could say to him is, I don't think you're saved. Well, then how can I be saved? Who put that anxiety there? The same God who totally undermined the morale of the Midianites and sent them into dread fear of an enemy only a fraction of their size. It corresponds to the work of God in every age. The great intelligence, and we're struggling to reach somebody, and suddenly we get an intelligence like a messenger. This person has mellowed. This person suddenly wants to listen to me. This person is asking me questions. And that's our modern equivalent of what happened to Gideon so long ago. Well, Gideon knew then that God had delivered his enemy into his hands. And so he proceeds with the 300 and the trumpets. They would have been ram's horns. And the pitchers, what have they got to do with it? Well, they're going to cover the flaming torches they were carrying. Our translation says lamps, but they would have been kind of pitch tarred flares, giving off a very bright light, probably with not only oily kind of bituminous things, but a bit of resin of some sort or another in them, so that they flared brightly. And they were concealed under the pitchers for a time so that they could carry out their mission in inky darkness. And then the time came when the pitchers were broken and the men shouted their heads off continuously. It's the tense as it's described. They didn't just give one shout. They went on shouting and blowing those ram's horns. Now, usually, we're told by the experts, there would be one ram's horn, maybe, for every 100 or so soldiers, because the ram's horn was used to signal to the troops by prearranged signals what they were to do, when they were to go forward, when they were to fall back. So to give every man, even in a small force like that, a ram's horn, and to have them on the hilltop around, all sounding at once, it sounded not like 300 ram's horns, but the ram's horns of 300 people at least, probably more, to the Midianites who were waking up and just coming to and gathering their wits. And the result was absolute consternation and tumult, and they fled their tents, and in the darkness, any of their fellows that fell into them was assumed to be an enemy and slaughtered. They were injuring and killing each other and running for all they were worth. And the 300 didn't even pursue them for a while, just went on sounding while they ran, and they didn't lift a finger to bring it about. But I have just time for a final heading, and it's the surprising offence. Because if we had read to the end of chapter 7, we would see how Gideon had then called up the Ephraimites. When the enemy was in flight, they'd gone, but they settled in Israelite land. They were no longer a fighting force. There were patches of people sleeping and trying to survive in the countryside, Midianite enemies. So there was time to mobilize his neighbors from Ephraim, and they were invited in to do the mopping up operation and to pursue the remnant and to throw them out and to destroy them. Well, that's very smart, because the Ephraimites wouldn't want the headship of Gideon. Their troops would be under their generals. They would want to do it their own way. As far as Gideon was concerned, that's fine. It's only the mopping up operation. They can now go and do the final clearing up and chase the people out. Now, this didn't satisfy the Ephraimites, the pride of Ephraim. They got hold of him afterwards, and they say to Gideon, it's in the early verses of chapter 8, "What are you doing? You didn't bring us in on this until the very end. You didn't summon us. Their pride is hurt. They're not going to share battle honors, which is what they want. They think they're always the people." And there could be civil war. It's serious. It's very, very sharp. And Gideon, with tremendous self-control and considering the unity of all Israel, using quaint language, he says, "Well, look at it this way. My harvest is much smaller than your harvest. You have conquered the princes who were put on the run. So your harvest, that is, fruits of battle, look what you've conquered. It's more than the number of princes that I have taken captive." Well, yes, because he'd given them the mopping up operation. So he praises them for their contribution, and everybody's happy. Well, they did redeem themselves. The oppressors were thrown out. Israel and Manasseh and all the tribes were united. And 40 years in due time, 40 years peace is the result. But it's the spiritual lessons. If we'd had time, I'd draw something from that last heading, the surprising offence. Sometimes when we're working for the Lord, we are so earthy, instead of thinking the Lord's work is everything, we might be tempted to think, I am not being given enough prominence in this. Somebody else has been made the leader of a department that maybe I think I should have had, and all this sort of thing. Well, fortunately, Gideon calms the whole situation and praises people for what they've done, and everybody then pulls together, and they're happy after that. But you get an insight here. Even for a mighty event like this, this human heart, even in Israel, will rise and say, "What about me? Why wasn't I considered? Why?" Always we have to put ourselves and our personal interests out of the picture. We're in the work of the Lord, And that's all that counts, to pray for souls and to be a blessing for him. So there's just some of the observations from a passage like this. The reasons for the sifting and some of these other things that we've considered. That's enough for us to think about this evening. Let's close singing together.